Hello, this is Luke Clancy and this is Culture File, and this evening we're in the comfort zone where we invite one of our favourites to talk about one of their favourites. I'm here, as I will be when we visit the comfort zone, with Colm Tobin. Hi Colm.
Hi Luke, how are you?
To sift through those parts of culture which for some of us tend to lie in the unopened box, and in the comfort zone we're going to pop the lid. And this time our special guest is author and academic Anna Kornbluh, who's Professor of English at the University of Illinois Chicago, but best known right now for her book Immediacy, or The Style of Too Late Capitalism, which, among other things, spots the rise of autofiction, Fleabag, and the front-facing camera on phones as signal flares of our desperate moment. But she's here today to share some love and fascination with the work of David Lynch, who of course died last month, or moved to the Black Lodge, depending on how you feel about Lynch law. And Anna Kornbluh has chosen in particular to talk to us about Lynch's Mulholland Drive. Big Irish-American vibes there. We're going to bring Anna Kornbluh in a minute, who we've had an amazing conversation with about Mulholland Drive. She kind of gave you a good reason maybe to watch it again. It has a lot of rewatchability, Mulholland Drive.
I mean, because I've been working for the last decade, really, on Ulysses, meaning that every year I do a seminar on it, I keep going back to it. I find new things. It's really worth studying. And the more you look at it, the more it yields. And therefore, I feel a film like this would be one in which you could really start reading a lot of critical work, like critics or people who've studied it. And you could benefit from that. I mean, you could really learn. And certainly this book by Anna Kornbluh called Immediacy, or The Style of Too Late Capitalism, is one that really takes you through the way, I think if you were thinking of going to university or going back to university or becoming a student again in your retirement or just getting involved more and being more rigorous about reading, I think this book would be a great help because it takes you through film, it takes you through novels, and it takes you through television, and it takes you through just various ways of thinking about art in a way that's so new and interesting and well put, with footnotes that just the amount of reading and the amount of care taken. Therefore, you could get somebody like Anna to talk about anything that interests you. And because she's got a bedrock or a groundwork in approaching things from angles or trying to see things more clearly using certain perspectives, then, getting her on Mulholland Drive was such a gift for me, such a gift.
So, first off, we've all given Mulholland Drive another view. Tell us, Anna, what form did you watch it in? What tube did it come through to you?
I'm still a big believer in the big screen, especially for films of this moment in this vintage where they were still shot in celluloid. So I watched it on a large screen in my living room. As a lover of of movies and TV, I watch on a big screen. And I'm pretty sure we watched it on Criterion, although I do confess it is my housemate's job to load the viewing material because it takes I like to joke, it takes longer to access the various platforms and services that you have than it did used to take to walk to the video store around the corner and get the
to Blockbuster.
But I'm pretty sure we watched it on Criterion. Sorry.
Did you darken the room?
It was at night. We did watch it at night, last week.
And Colm, how did you do your consumption?
My partner is really good at all that. So I think he has a projector. At least he seems to come into the room with a projector, which he then takes a painting down off the wall. It's by a friend, she doesn't mind. And then he projects it onto white wall. And so we sit on a sofa, it's night. And we usually argue beforehand about what we're going to watch. And then we argue afterwards about what we've seen. We have nothing in common. And this is just one way, I suppose, personifying that and making that seem real and true, that we don't have anything in common.
So both of those are kind of like a way of reproducing, like giving it quite a cinematic atmosphere and kind of taking it away from the streaming world, which is kind of interesting. Anna, so what is your history with David Lynch's work? I mean, did you ever come across him? Did you ever encounter him in bodily form?
Oh, I never did encounter him in bodily form, much though I admire the coif and the quiet. But my history is, as it were, that at a formative and adolescent moment, Twin Peaks was on TV. And my parents were kind of cool enough to know this is not usual TV. And so within the first couple weeks of it premiering, when I was, a teenager, my parents started hosting parties on Thursday night to watch Twin Peaks because it was just like, what is this art going on? What is this weirdness going on? You can do that on TV, And they had these Thursday night parties, and we would stay up late, and it was so weird. And so, trying to integrate that as a teenager, so I think I, my first exposure, as it were, but it remains the formative one, is to think of him as, this kind of magic artist who really was trying to stretch the bounds of different media. But I never did meet him.
The idea here, Colm, is that this is something that you did not watch as a child, and did not your family did not host parties to celebrate Twin Peaks. Well, how did you come across David Lynch first?
I didn't.
Okay.
I remember the hype around Twin Peaks, and I must have watched the beginning of something and but didn't. I'm not really interested in film. We didn't have a television, when I was growing up until a certain moment. I watched Batman. But I didn't have a interest, film culture. I didn't see how. I didn't know there was such a thing. In fact, there was a local cinema called the Flea Pit, and you went there, but it wasn't for the purpose of watching a film. It was for every other purpose. And I never saw a film that interested me until I went to university, and then, of course, it was only Bergman, and there was only Bergman, and maybe a bit of Buñuel. The problem was that I had no idea what was happening. As a novelist, I panic when that happens, because if you did that in narrative, you'd have to be very deliberate about it to make absolutely clear to the reader you're not going to know where this is, who this is. But more significantly, I think what this is this a dream? Is this camera moving, attempting to represent something that will eventually unfold? Or is it playing a trick? And if it is playing a trick, I couldn't see the trick at the opening of Twin Peaks, and I certainly couldn't see it with Mulholland Drive. So that for this program with my partner, we sat down again, and I so fundamentally misunderstood the film. I mean, not just its tricks, its textures. I misunderstood literally what was happening. So in the more, and I'll come to that in a minute, but in the morning I woke up, and he woke up luckily as well, and I said to him, now, at the opening of that film, now what we're presuming is that that woman in that car at the opening of the film is they're making a film, and that's why that seems so strange. And he said, "What are you talking about?" In other words, I had utterly, utterly misread the film, and so that's my. I mean, I have more to say because I'm sort of attempting to come round to this. And I've been immersed in this. So, I mean, the reason I'm going to stop talking now is that I desperately want to hear Anna on Mulholland Drive.
Thanks so much for reading and also for going down a journey of a kind of art that you don't like and a medium that you don't like. I just want to say that you're not at the back of the class. The confusion that you're talking about, I think, is central to this film and to all of Lynch's oeuvre. And that's what's so interesting about him, is he wants there to be that kind of instability of, am I in a dream? Am I in a movie? Am I in reality? And Mulholland Drive is, perhaps the sort of best about that because it's the most Los Angeles centric of that, right? And so that notion that you would watch a movie and wonder, which parts of it were about making movies and which parts of it were the dreams or the fantasies, which are actually, kind of different things, right? Of the people who are in it, that idea of those blended all together, that there's an industry that gives us fantasies, there's an industry that teaches us how to dream and how to desire, and that we don't know, or our fantasies aren't even properly our own when we live in such an image culture. And maybe when we are Angelenos or when we're fans of Hollywood, like that's really so much of what that movie is about.
I mean, plot is a pretty contentious word with David Lynch in general. Even what are the events of Mulholland Drive doesn't seem quite right. So I suppose, Anna, what do we watch when we watch Mulholland Drive?
So I do think it's funny that you guys say that because in a lot of ways the biggest chunk of it is actually much straighter than most Lynch films, right? So that there is kind of a plot, which is that The Rita character is in a car accident while she is driving through the most dramatic avenue of Los Angeles, right? And that she suffers some memory loss, and she finds her way into an apartment where an older actress has left, and there is then therefore a kind of opening, and a younger actress has arrived, who's the Betty character, right? The Naomi Watts character. And that even though there's something extremely strange for Betty about coming upon this woman who is amnesiac and beautiful in her aunt's apartment, she is credulously involved in trying to help her figure out her story. Like, what happened? Was I in an accident? You know, where did I live? And it launched this little investigation. And most of the movie is that kind of straightforward story, right?
Well, you say maybe that that's more straightforward than some David Lynch films, but from that opening scene where Betty arrives at LAX, we notice something in the style of her performance where we think, what I'm seeing isn't what I'm seeing in some way. And that, I mean, that's pretty much a standard David Lynch ploy, that you are watching something, but what you think is going on is not what's going on. And I mean, in Mulholland Drive, without giving spoilers away on such an old film, you know, it turns out that perhaps we were seeing something that was not as reliable as it first was presented.
True. And also that one shouldn't be able to quite rightly, you know, differentiate among them, right? Because reality is sustained by fantasy, right? All of our kind of social reality of everyday life and of, well, having a functioning government, which of course we don't have at this point, right? But is, you know, sort of what Freud called civilization, right? Is sort of held together by various kinds of projective identifications, various kinds of fantastical, nonsensical nuggets, and by our kind of deals that we make with our own desires and what's legitimate and what's not and what's permissible and what's speakable and, you know, or admittable or repressible. And so it's that sort of interrelation of like reality, the real fantasy, that I think Lynch is really good at capturing. And it doesn't ask of us to adjudicate what's real, because desire is real and fantasy is real, right?
When that scene of the woman in the car and the two men in the front of the car going into Mulholland Drive, am I to take it that this woman did come to the city, was in this car, there was an accident, or is this in some way what the camera is doing with illusion? And what the camera is free to do, and what David Lynch is free to imagine, and what I'm lured into accepting, but I'm still a positivist. You know, I still want to know. Like, help me.
There definitely is a sort of canonical way of reading Mulholland Drive, which is that halfway through the film is reality, and what precedes it is sort of something dreamt by this aging actress whose career is sort of on the rocks, and that we live half the film in a dream, and then the bit that we see after that sort of decodes various figures in the dream for us. I mean, there is a real world in this David Lynch film.
Yeah, and the real world is one of women who have, you know, been used up, you know, kind of corporally and sexually and emotionally by the industry that they're in. So that's the kind of last little chunk there. But the alternative of dream, you know, I suggested it's fantasy and that those are kind of technically different. But in either case, we're subject to yes, a woman was really in a car, but that car is a kind of overdetermined signifier, as Freud would say, right? And that every kind of image which is in a dream is a number of things bound to each other by weird wordplay and by mechanisms that are very literary, right? That Freud sort of elaborated: condensation, displacement, dramatization, allegory. These are metaphor, metonymy, and so on, right? And so that what does it mean to have a beautiful woman in the backseat of a car who's being driven, who thinks that she's in charge? What are you doing? We don't stop here. But she's not in charge, right? Because she's not driving. And these men, who she doesn't actually know, are choosing where to stop. And they are also, you know, have some kind of detour in the agenda, right? And then this other car crash comes, you know, which is these kind of wild, unregulated teenagers, right, who are engaged in reckless behavior, but they're on the least safe street in the whole city of Los Angeles, which is the most car-oriented city in the country and so on, right? So all of these things are just kind of bound together, that the way that in the real part of the movie, as it were, women have been used up by the image industry and by, you know, presenting themselves as starlets who are to be desired, that real part of the world is also very intimately related to, bound up, tied to car culture, the mythology of our nation, expansiveness, men pulling the strings, right? That there's a whole kind of power field there. And so the dream sequence, the fantasy sequence, you can interpret the different figures that get knotted together or that lead into the determinations. And those interpretations are real, right? Like real descriptions of our world. There's something very strange about Los Angeles being the, you know, and you can read Mike Davis's great book about Los Angeles, right? Being the city that is the center of producing how to fantasize and how to imagine for the entire world, right? This is the center of the global cultural industry.
There is a quality to David Lynch that I don't find in all artistic expression or culture, where watching a David Lynch film is a moment in life rather than a moment consuming art. There's a kind of an intensity in engaging with the David Lynch film that just isn't available other places. Anna?
I mean, I think that when an object demands our attention, when it confuses us and befuddles us, but also attaches us in ways that we want to talk about it afterwards on the couch or on a podcast or, you know, go read some fan blogs or even some academic articles about, like, that incitement to meaning making is really, really pleasing. I think it really hits at a core human capacity for, you know, curiosity and creativity, and that is not satisfied by very flat art of the kind that we have a lot of demand for. You know, instant access, direct message, my art has the right politics, and you're going to get it. And you're going to get it fast, and you're going to get it even though you're watching it on your iPhone while you're also, you know, commuting or while you're also, say, working your remote job. and so that the shows that build into them or the artworks that build into them, that you have diminished attention and that they're not supposed to make a high demand on you. That's kind of like the style that we're in, and it's not very satisfying, I don't think. So I think Lynch is unusual in befuddling us and also arresting us and, and dazzling us. And he has a kind of coherent style in a way of many great Hollywood directors, but it does pertain to these weirdnesses and thicknesses and opacities that, you know, require us to process and to rewatch and to be, you know, tolerant of not being placated or satisfied or not knowing what really happened, not having resolution about the plot or what's reality. And that's a different aesthetic experience than, like, you know, a rom-com where I know what's going to happen. And I love rom-coms, so, like, I'm not saying that, but, like, the that quality of, lingering in the processing and being asked to make meaning with other people afterwards and around an object, it's special, I think, and it's rare right now.
I think this is a great manifesto, you know, for anyone who's working, where there are times when you're working, you think, this is boring, what I'm doing, and it's got to stop being boring. How do I stop being boring? And you think, oh, should I make myself more clear? I said, no, please don't do that. You're making yourself clear enough. In other words, am I writing these boring sentences? Yes. Should I stop doing that? Yes. How do I do that? Is there a way in which I can make the thoughts of this character, say, or the actions more interesting, more mysterious, more unexpected? But if I go into the easy business of, I am sad, I cry. What if I'm sad and I don't do anything at all? I don't even use the word sad. There's just something has occurred. It's in the air, and I must, and you, as you're writing, don't give easy feelings to characters. constantly working in terms of, is there any way I can make this, in a way, suggest true, but true is a terrible word. What's your problem? Well, your problem is that you're trying to darken a room so that the movie that's been showing all along on that wall of ours, we can't see it in daytime. What if in daytime you're working towards making the movie visible in some way for someone crossing the room? They would turn for a second and on the wall it would be showing, flickering first and then more clear. And what I want from that experience, what I see then, is something that engages me visually. And I suppose that's what I was getting this time from it being forced to sit on the sofa to watch Mulholland Drive. But whatever is happening, I am watching something that I don't understand. And that has to be more satisfying than watching an ad for soap. It's come up with me big time now because I have a novel out. And I just honestly thought the ending made everything pretty clear. Just a novel is an arc and it has to go, you know, it isn't a circle and it isn't a line, it's an arc. And so it goes around and it goes down. And then you bring it down a bit further and then you end the book. And well, the number of consumers writing to me as though I have broken some I can be found easily because I have a website and you can just click on contact. It comes straight to me and I read it immediately. But it's just constantly as though there's a consumer question, as though the soap they got didn't actually help them get clean. But it is about the ending. But it is about the ending doesn't tell you enough. And this is an argument Henry James had with George Eliot in the 1870s. It's not a new argument. But nonetheless, it's urgent now in the sense, not I want to know what happened. You have neglected to tell me something. You keep going back to, no, no, that's as much as I know. You cannot interpret this easily.
Right.
Because if you do, it will satisfy you even less if I give you something simple. That, for example, in my first watching of Mulholland Drive, I was so uneasy. I was so uncomfortable. My comfort zone was all about, no, no, hold on. Did she or didn't she get out of the car? Is there a car? You know, therefore, but your sort of manifesto, I suppose, is against easiness.
Well, so I think it's a little tricky here because there forever artists have wanted more difficulty, right? And wanted to make manifest that art should be more difficult. And I'm less trying to say like, you know, don't make easy art. Why is it that we have a whole matrix of cultural values that lead your readers to think of themselves as customers and to think that they can give you a star rating because you didn't get them clean with the soap, right? What is it that overshapes that response? And I do think that we have a culture of unbearable haste and hurry and precarity, which puts a real vice grip on the time that we have for art and pleasure and curiosity and uncertainty. People who are reading a book like yours, they're obviously trying hard, right? They're trying to get something that is edifying or pleasing or, you know, is different than reading, as it were, like airport thrillers or Colleen Hoover or, you know, and people have different reasons they read those. But they're trying to get something. But the very imperative that, like, they needed there to be the lesson. They need for it to be transmittable. They need it to be more rapidly uptakeable. That imperative is shaped by our broader economic forces and our broader political forces. And that's what I'm trying to provide context for. You should say to these individual readers, I'm not selling soap. I'm sorry you're still dirty, right? I understand your dilemma there, but you can't say to them, please have a reading group with your neighbors where you read the book and discuss it together and see if you come up with a way to understand the ending or recommendations for how it could have been shaped differently. But, you know, go forth and make more meaning together. But the idea that people need time to do those things and they need the missing kind of social infrastructures that we don't really have anymore, like to do those things, that is a political and economic problem, you know.
So many other things that we could have talked about. And one of the things, like, I just find the Silencio scene just such an ecstasy, where her partner wakes up in the middle of the night and says, we have to go somewhere now. And she's been sort of talking in her sleep that they end up in this nightclub.
where there's a cabaret performance. How did you encounter it? What were you seeing?
I think there are moments, and it happens more for me in poetry, where I'm reading a poem and I'm not, I have to give up following the sense, and I have to let the music of the poetry come in towards me. I have to be lured along. It happens, for example, in John Ashbery, but it happens in a lot of contemporary, especially American poetry, where it's almost abstract for a second. It's almost like Catholicism, where you know, in order to believe, you have to believe. You have to have a leap of faith before you can do it. It used to be called the paradox of faith when I was trying to be a priest. And it was the same idea of there are moments when I'd simply have to say, stop resisting this. Just give up for a second. Do what you do with poetry sometimes. Just see what will happen.
So I love that poetry is where you went with that, because this is the interlude in the film that is about sound and about music, and that poses a little bit of, alternative to how much the film is about images, right? She wakes up from a dream on a word and on a phrase, and it's Spanish. And why is it Spanish? And does everybody speak Spanish in Los Angeles? And then they go to the, you know, kind of cabaret, but it's also kind of an auditorium, and the singer is unaccompanied. Right, like that's no, she doesn't have the band, but she's singing Roy Orbison. But it's just this kind of strange moment of like, well, cinema actually is all the senses, and we let the images overpower us, but music plays this huge role in doing that, and also. The myths that sort of shape our desires do have linguistic components to them, even if we don't speak the language of our own desires.
The other thing I was thinking there was the conversation from all the cabaret artists is, this is fake, this isn't real, what you're seeing isn't what it is. And then when the song comes on, when the Spanish version of Crying comes on, as a human, you can't resist, I feel, feeling incredibly intense emotion, despite having spent 5 or 6 minutes being told that everything here is an artifice. And David Lynch's films are a little bit like that. He spends so much time telling us the confit that he's made, and somehow or other that other thing keeps poking through.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Are you talking about Schmaltz?
There's an awful lot of content all around the interwebs about Mulholland Drive. You know, there's a huge site, mulhollanddrive.net, which is sort of like a whole Wikipedia for you to interpret and to watch Mulholland Drive. But I wonder, like, how much do you enjoy not doing all the research first and just facing it like you did with Mulholland Drive? Is that what kind of experience is that for you?
With something like Ulysses, once you start going through the critical work, you find that what was being written 30 years ago is out of fashion. And it's also true that with the biographical work on, say, Joyce, you need only basic facts. So therefore, the question of interpretation is, you're using, no matter what you're doing, you're reading a book in the present tense. You're reading it now, and you're bringing the prejudices, not just the prejudices of now, but the actual knowledge now of how narrative works, how style works, how character works, even how anti-Semitism works, or how feminism works, or how nationalism works, or how colonialism works. No matter what you're doing, even if you go to something cold, you're bringing an awful lot with you. I mean, in a way, you're bringing your citizenship into the room. You really need to go back to college in your own spirit, really once a year, to find, I need to go and look at how this was constructed, because if I don't, I'm missing the point of it. And some works, Ulysses is a good example, I think Mulholland Drive is another, that the more you would study it, just the more engaged you become, the more excited you become, and the more richly you read. And the more richly you read, the more richly you start reading other things, such as The World.
And that's hopefully what we'll do in the next few episodes of The Comfort Zone. Colin, thank you very much. See you next time.
Thank you, Luke. Thank you.